There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Castaway, what's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
This week's guest is not very happy with me at all. Her name is Hanana Zahir, and she hates the fact that she has to choose three books.
Hi, yes, that was the hardest thing to do this week. I feel like I spent hours in front of my bookshelf just picking out one book after the other.
If you don't know Hanana, so I'm just going to give you a little introduction here. So she's a short story writer. Her work has appeared in several literary magazines and journals. She was a finalist for the Doris Betts Fiction Prize in 2014. She received a fellowship from the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts and was a Pushcart nominee. And she's also founded something called Literary Salon. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Dubai Literary Salon is a prose reading series here in Dubai. There's a lot of poetry stuff that's happening, and it's fantastic, but us fiction writers are feeling a little bit left out. So we decided we wanted to go somewhere and share our work as well. So there's a few of us, and we meet once a month. We've hosted authors like Mohsen Hamid, who was a Man Booker finalist last year. And, you know, a lot of local writers from Abu Dhabi, around the Middle East, if they're traveling through. You know, it's a nice place to come, talk about literature, hear some stories, share your work.
Speaking of sharing and talking about books, what's the first book that you've got with you on your island?
So the first book was Gone with the Wind, which is, I recognize now, a very tricky book to love.
Yeah.
And I thought about it a lot. But it is one of those things that was a formative experience for me when I was growing up. And so there it is. It has to be one of the books.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions. When I was looking into Gone with the Wind, I was thinking, oh, okay. But a lot of the time on Castaway, the books that kind of that people choose are the ones that found them at the right place and time that had a formative effect on them growing up. Do you remember the first time that you read Gone with the Wind?
I do. I was 14.
Yeah.
And I think it was just popular at the time in my high school. I don't know why. I just kind of picked it up and I couldn't stop reading it. I think I read it about 22 times. And I would still happily read it again. It's interesting because this was in Pakistan. I grew up in Pakistan, and then I moved to the South in the U.S. So I actually feel like it helped me transition and understand a culture that wasn't my own before I got there in a funny kind of way. So it was formative in that way. I loved Scarlett. I thought I was Scarlett for a little while.
Oh, dear.
So I think there's, you know, there was that sort of influence on me as well.
Speaking of Scarlett, for a lot of people, she's this really annoying, spoiled character. Whether you've read the book or you've watched the film, did you like her?
I loved her. I thought she was just, you know, I don't care about anything. I'm going to follow my path. I think what I saw in her was a lot stronger than what other people see. And it was very attractive to me. I found her very, very compelling as a character to relate to.
And I think actually, and this is coming from a male's point of view, I've read that book several times and I'm so glad that you picked it, because I think a lot of writers never want to admit that they've read Gone with the Wind or that they really enjoy it. It kind of comes off as this very like Mills and Booney type book when it's not really. To me, it's a classic and it's ahead of its time in a lot of ways. And I think especially the character of Scarlett is really ahead of her time, not only in the time that she was living in, but even reading back now, she was a feminist in a way. She was a modern businesswoman. She was, like you said, carving her own path. So I think it's a really good book that you've... I think it's really great that you're actually talking about
it. Thank you. I think so, too. But I do agree with you. I do feel like she was, in her time, especially for her time and her context and the place where she grew up. I mean, we're talking about Civil War and Reconstruction era. Mm. Women didn't do that kind of stuff. So she is an example of somebody who's, you know, who women can look at and kind of say, that's a strongly female person.
And it was written in 1930 something.
It was right in the middle of
36.
Right
after
36. Yeah. So even then, the time it was published, women were still not, you know, making, working or doing a lot of things in society as Scarlett was.
As she was, absolutely.
Yeah.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Talking of Books on Dubai Eye 103.8. And we are in the middle of our Castaway segment with Hanana Zahir. And we're talking about Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell. Have you seen the film adaptation?
Yeah, several times.
Several times. So I'm guessing that you like it.
I do like it. I love the book. I never find movies as good as the book, but I have watched it a few times. I think it's one of the few movies that, even though it's 4 hours long, does not feel 4 hours long to me.
And it's one of the movies, I think that best is adapted from a novel. I think it's actually one of the best, in my opinion.
I think they've really stayed close to the actual telling.
Yeah.
I was reading something about it the other day, how they said the making of the movie was very problematic and all kinds of issues coming up, but it is still my guilty pleasure. So
I do love reading about movie trivia, and particularly the film that was made from Gone with the Wind. So apparently, when adjusted for monetary inflation, it is still the most successful film in box office history. And that really surprised me, because often when you're talking about box office, obviously Titanic or Avatar or whatever. Actually, I don't know what the current biggest box office.
Avengers Infinity Wars, yeah.
Really?
Right now? Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, when you adjust for monetary inflation, it is still the most successful film in box office history. And I find that really interesting. And also, I think the one that everybody knows is how difficult it was to find a Scarlet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the number of people that they brought in for readings versus the number of people that applied to be Scarlet, and they ended up with Vivien Leigh.
I actually know a little fun fact about that, is that Vivien Leigh first went on the set when they were filming the scene of the fire in the war. And that fire was actually an old set from a different movie they'd filmed, and they just decided to film the fire, and she'd come on to meet the director for the first time during that scene.
Interesting.
She directed that?
No, she didn't direct it. She met the director for the first time when they were filming that burning scene.
The fire scene.
I had this whole new respect for Vivien Leigh. So apparently, 14,000 actresses, I have it here, were interviewed for the role of Scarlett O'Hara.
14,000.
400 were invited to do readings. And then for more publicity, and I love this, fans were invited to vote for their favorite actresses. Vivien Leigh received only one vote, but Margaret Mitchell personally approved the choice. And I think that when the author approves it, often, you know, that helps.
It probably matches the vision.
Exactly.
She really, to me, I can't imagine who else might have played that. There's something about her physical being as well that matches the character so well.
And what's interesting is that she's British. She's not American.
Right.
And she had that accent down, and she really understood the character, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. Good choice.
We've talked a lot about Scarlett, but we have to talk about Rhett as well. We have to talk about Scarlett and Rhett and that whole
Rhett
love story. Thoughts?
I love Rhett. I think I may have a disposition where I like people who are not liked by other people or something. I don't know. Rhett is also not very popular, I think, generally, just because he's a strong character. But towards the end of the book, he kind of plays into and sort of gives into, the old way of being, and I think a lot of people criticize the character for that. But there's something very I think you were talking about evil and good and heroes and villains, just, you know, with the last segment, and something about a villain which is just attractive. He's, you know, also making his own path and doing things unapologetically.
Is he the quintessential bad boy?
He's the bad boy that I think most women assume bad boys are, because he's got a nice heart on the inside. So possibly not all the way bad boy.
I have to say, people, I think Scarlett O'Hara is an anti-hero, right? We're seeing her sort of disintegrate throughout this novel. And I think, in a funny way, Rhett Butler is her good core. He's always forcing her to do good. And what's so interesting about him is that you think he's this guy who just loves to dress well, and he's kind of doesn't care what anybody thinks, but he's so intelligent. He's like quoting all these philosophers throughout the novel, and nobody really gets it. And what's interesting is Ashley Wilkes, who's the guy that Scarlett is in love with. Everyone thinks he's this great, debonair, upstanding citizen, but really, the whole time he's kind of teasing Scarlett, even though he's married. So again, back to your point of good and evil, who is the real good man, who is the evil
man? Exactly. And I think that's kind of one of the things about this novel that's so interesting, is because it's easy to take positions of good and evil and say this is not good and this is bad, but with these characters, once you sort of tap into the humanity of them and you see that there's, you know, sides to every person and there's a good and there's a bad, it's interesting to follow them and see how their journey goes.
Are you glad that she was inundated for requests to write a sequel to this and she refused? I think some people have done like television spin-offs of it and whatnot, but she didn't want to write a sequel because she said that she left them to their ultimate fate, Scarlett and Rhett. Are you happy she didn't? Are you happy that she left it where she did? And what do you think happened to them?
So I did read the sequel. I don't know that it was her who wrote it.
It was somebody else.
Yeah, it was somebody else. I did read that, which was not as satisfying.
Yeah.
But I think with these characters, the world she's created, it's hard not to want to follow it. I did want, you know, to read, to keep reading and find out what happened. And then there was a parody that somebody wrote called The Wind Done Gone. So I read that as well. And so I've kind of been trying to sort of, you know, soak up whatever Gone with the Wind stuff I can. But in a funny way, I mean, I think that's sort of what I do with my own fiction, is you leave the characters where people can imagine. It leaves them with a little bit of angst. And that's, I think that's why I keep coming back to this book, because I want it to resolve every time and it goes the same way.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
So we were just talking about Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell, which is your first pick, after deliberating for a very long time.
Very long time.
This is a difficult process for you.
It was very difficult. I also wanted to do To Kill a Mockingbird because that was my original first Southern novel. And then I sort of settled on this because I would read this over and over.
Before we move on, though, I'm completely heartbroken by how Margaret Mitchell died.
Yeah, she was out with her husband. I think they were shopping or something, and she got hit by a car. I think it was a taxi. And she was quite young. I think she was in her 50s. And she died on the scene. And she apparently, I know that the internet told you something, Annabelle, but I heard that she was, I read that she was, her son found after she passed away that she was planning some kind of sequel to Gone with the Wind, but she'd never written it.
Because I think what I found was that the film companies were pressuring her to write a sequel so that they could make a film of the sequel. So it stands to reason that she would say no, but would continue to kind of dabble in her own time.
Mm.
That makes sense. Now, moving on to your second book, Reveal, book number two for us.
Book number two would be Pablo Neruda's 20 Love Poems and a Song of Despair.
When did you first come across Neruda?
This was actually more recently, I would say about 8 or 9 years ago,
mm-hmm.
Which I find very surprising. It was one of those, I picked up, or I saw one of his poems somewhere and I kind of went, why have I never seen this before? But it just, in my own writing process, I think I was in the place where I was no longer writing poetry anymore. I was just doing fiction. And I was also missing just nature and, you know, the desert is great, the beach is great, but I love sort of the mountains and trees and nature and, you know, that kind of thing. And for some reason, the combination of his poetry and being in the place where I was, it just really resonated with me.
So I'm guessing you read it in English?
I did.
Translation?
My Spanish is very poor. But that's one of the reasons to take it on the island, because I could probably practice and learn some Spanish.
Yeah, brilliant. Have you read Neruda before?
I haven't. No, I haven't read it. But I wanted to ask you whether, which I think is a really interesting question to ask a writer, of whether, especially a fiction writer, if whether reading poetry helps to dictate or influence or feed your fiction writing. Do you get any influence from that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the thing with poetry is because you're trying to compress meaning into few words. It really makes you practice, you know, sort of using one word to say 10 different things or where you place it. And I try to do a lot of that with fiction as well, because even though I'm writing longer stories and some of them are 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 words, I'm, you know, there's not a lot of spare space. So I kind of try to use the same exercise or copy some of the same techniques for fiction as well.
Mm. I think it's interesting what you said about not having ever seen it before, because I did some research about this. So obviously he's a Chilean poet, and I was surprised to learn that he was the former senator of Chile. I had no idea. And apparently, so there's a line from a review in the New York Times that says, no writer of world renown is perhaps so little known to North Americans as Chilean poet Pablo Neruda. And apparently part of that is the fact that he's a tough one to translate.
Well, so that's one of the interesting things that I guess any translations are tough.
Yeah.
And Spanish is such a fluid lyrical language that I can't imagine that in English it's, I mean, it sounds amazing in English, but I can't imagine what it must sound like in Spanish.
I first read Neruda in school in Argentina, like in Spanish. And it was at a time when I was struggling to read a lot of the fiction that we were talking about. And I was thinking, oh goodness, poetry, I'm not going to understand a single thing. And I open Neruda and everything makes sense, even though you don't understand absolutely everything. And it's the musicality of the language as well. And I was so delighted that you chose it as well, because it made me look at his poems translated into English. And okay, and I was thinking, they're not going to be Like it's right. it's going to be like listening to somebody sing through a wall almost. Right. And I looked at the poem and it still comes through in English.
It's just the way it's so accessible. I think just the imagery of it and the way he connects certain emotions to natural elements and what it means. And it's just, you know, there's so much rawness there that I think any of us can sort of, you know, understand it and relate to it.
And he writes about love in such a brilliant way. And it's one of the toughest topics for, I think, even the best of poets to tackle, because it's such a big thing.
It is.
When he writes about it, it all just falls into place and it all makes sense. And you love him, but you kind of hate him at the same time.
It hits the perfect note of sadness and angst and happiness and joy and getting it and don't want it, not wanting to get it, like you said. I think he's truly one of the most incredible poets. Actually, I think Garcia Marquez said he was the best poet of our time or something, which coming from him is high praise. So
I thought what would be nice would be to read, I found a really tiny excerpt from the Song of Despair. Obviously, I found the Song of Despair was the bit that I liked the most because I'm a bit depressed by that. It is the hour of departure, the hard, cold hour in which the night fastens to all timetables. The rustling belt of the sea girdles the shore. Cold stars heave up, blackbirds migrate, deserted like the wharves at dawn, only the tremulous shadow twists in my hands. I love the line about night fastens to all timetables.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And I actually haven't read poetry in translation that sounds so close to the original. So kudos to the translator.
Kudos to the translator and to the man.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So why this particular collection? Was it the only one that you read or...?
No, so I've read other things. I think this is the one that I read first.
Right.
So it left an impression. Also, there's another poem in there, which is Leaning into the Afternoons. Mm-hmm. And something about that poem just grabbed me. It's just this image of leaning into the afternoons. I think it goes, leaning into the afternoons, I cast my sad nets towards your oceanic eyes. And just something about those two lines has just grabbed me.
I've got goosebumps.
Yeah.
I will read that over and over, and it does the same thing to me every single time.
Do you read much poetry, Ron?
I used to when I was younger. I really loved Alice Walker's poetry. I was obsessed with her work. And Emily Dickinson I've read over and over again. But I never have, I don't want to say time for poetry, but I always feel like there's time to read it later. I always have fiction in my hand, which I think is a real issue because, like you were saying before, how important it is to read poetry if you're a writer, because it really, and to me, poetry is like the most condensed form of the English language. And I think it's really important to give your brain a break from fiction and read something like poetry. I feel like it's the mechanics of good language.
And I also think that for a lot of people, I don't know about you, but the first time that you find a poet that really speaks to you, you remember that. Mm-hmm. Because I remember when I was at school reading a lot of poetry, I thought, you know, we analysed it in class and it was interesting and you got stuff out of it. But there's always the one poem or the one poet that makes you think, ah, this is why we read this.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think it's that feeling of awe. That's
yes.
exactly what it is, because I've read a lot of, like, Emily Dickinson and, the Romantics. And I think Byron had a little bit of a hold on me for a little while. But it's only when I now read poetry, I think, maybe it's growing up as well. But now when I read poetry, I come to that awe moment much more often, I think, because I'm, you know, sort of reading it not just to analyze, but to just kind of see, like, what is this saying? And sometimes it'll really speak to you.
Castaway, what's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
Now, remind us of your first two choices so far.
So the first one was Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. The second one was Pablo Neruda, 20 Love Poems and a Song of Despair. And this is, in my opinion, a book everybody should read in their life. It's F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby.
Oh, I've never heard of that one.
No,
yeah, neither.
It's a really good book. You should try it.
So, The Great Gatsby, why does everybody rave about it? When did you first read it?
I think I must have read it in college somewhere for one of my courses, because the first time was not memorable
right.
at all. But as I've gotten older, I've read it over and over. And I think by now it's turned into a serious obsession.
What why the obsession?
I just think it is a brilliant novel, just as a writer.
Yeah.
It is considered by many the perfect novel, which means that it has, you know, the tight plot, the language is just fantastic. I mean, it's fluid, poetical, and yet so concise. And, you know, there's not a lot of, you don't find yourself skipping pages or paragraphs ever, which is a lot to say for a novel. And also just the characters are so interesting and relatable, and they have all these complexities of, you know, weaknesses and strengths, and also the love. I think, at, you know, we were talking about love earlier, and I think Gatsby also makes you go, like, makes your heart ache a little bit, which is always a good recipe for a book.
The dynamic, though, is it, do you find it similar in any way to Rhett and Scarlet, or do you think it's completely different?
I think it's completely different. I think that I find it actually similar to Neruda's poems, because it has yearning in it, which I think Scarlet and Rhett are sort of just, you know, going forward in life and taking whatever they can from their path. This is sort of a reflective, sit back, look, yearn, you know, want kind of love, which is, I think, a little bit more attractive, maybe.
We were talking about Gone with the Wind earlier, and Scarlet and Rhett, their main characters, and we've just had a text message in from Deborah. Scarlet is a strong, multi-layered character. At the beginning, she is strong-willed and forthright, which are not endearing qualities, but it is these qualities that ultimately bring her through adversity. That was a nice way of summing it up, really.
That is a really nice way of putting it.
So remind us of the main two characters. Obviously, Gatsby.
There's Daisy. There's Daisy's husband, Tom. And there's Nick Carraway, who tells the whole story.
And so it's quite a short novel. And often a lot of people say, quite rightly, that it's one of the best-written novels, because it's... Everything is kind of condensed into like less than 200 pages, I think. And he manages to cover so much ground. In terms of the language, is there anything that you would like to read out? I'll give you like time to find it.
I actually know exactly what line I like. It's the last bit. It's the last four. I mean, there's so much beautiful stuff. Do you want me to read it out right now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. It's the last four lines, or the last five lines. Gatsby believed in the green light. The orgastic future that year by year recedes before us. It eluded us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we will run faster, stretch out our arms farther, and one fine morning. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites as well, because it always comes up on the best closing lines in literature.
It just is, and I think, I have to admit, I watched the movie as well, even though I resisted for a while, and even in the movie, just the way they've presented that last line, it's the pitch perfect.
You mean the latest movie, the one with DiCaprio?
With Leo, yes.
Yeah. It's very different from the original with, I think it's Robert Redford. Yeah.
I decided to go ahead and watch it because why not? And yeah. Leonardo DiCaprio. I thought it was good-ish. It was a little bit different from what I expected. But
he took the whole jazz lifestyle, music, and really made that a really, you know,
central,
magnified
yeah.
that in the film.
He did. But I think that, you know, there's no way to do justice to this book in a regular movie. So I think what he did with it was probably the best interpretation.
Yeah. It's so funny because you picked the, because I read more, I've always read more British or novelists or writers and books about the UK or Europe. And you've picked the two books about American life and American culture that I love. I think The Great Gatsby is one of the most amazing stories I've ever read. And I read Benjamin Button when I was younger. And then I came across this and I thought it would be the same, but it was completely different. And it was really mind-boggling. And what's interesting is that it's similar to Gone with the Wind, is that they're both about appearances and people and society and how that affects things, like with Daisy and how she's sort of so obsessed with what people are, you know, her lifestyle, what people are going to say. And even though, you know, she kind of is in love with Gatsby, there's all these things in the way. Parallel is interesting.
I agree. And I think also just it's so such a current book, even though it was written a while ago, because the kind of concerns that these characters have are, we can see them in daily life around us. And I think you were talking about Daisy, and I think one of the things I find interesting about her is that she's the opposite of Scarlet, which is she has almost no agency, and she's depending on men to kind of give her status or define her place in life, which, you know, for current feminism conversations.
Yeah.
Is a great example to look at.
I love the character of Gethu because I thought in any other time you would think like such a self-made person and a person who's like obsessed with someone would be seen sort of as more lovable in a way, but I think he's just stuck in this bad place I think he's just in love with the wrong person.
I think he's in love with love, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't even know that it's a
person. I think he used the best word before. He said there's this ache.
Yeah.
And when you read about him, you just feel so...
You feel something for him. Yeah. But I think that's one of the successes of the novel as well, is because people like that, you know, it is the great American dream to come from nothing and to succeed at such a grand scale. And I think for him, there's a lot of people who can relate to that, but also there is a bit of... Well, he succeeded, and look what's going to happen to him at the end. It's sort of like a lesson in there as well. So works in a lot of levels.
The love story, that's one that I've always not entirely understood. It's always frustrated me. But I think maybe the frustration of them, like it never quite happening, is what makes you kind of race through it. And then those last few lines are just, they break your heart.
That's I think, and that's the beauty of it. And I'm just realizing as we're talking about these, is I think that's the same thing that I said we like about Gone with the Wind, is you don't know. You want desperately for that resolution, and it's not there. And here, it's clearly not there. Mm-hmm. But I think those are the things that bring you back to it. Again, the impulse to kind of have it resolved differently, and it won't. And you know it won't.
It's so obvious now that you say it, but I'd never really considered that actually all the books that I go back to again and again and I find myself still thinking about the characters are the ones where the final destination of their journey was never kind of outlined.
You don't have the satisfaction, you never will. And the writer's literally toying with you, saying you can read this as many times as you want and they will never get where you want them to get. And I think that's the delicious aspect of it.
It's also slightly cruel.
Yeah.
Have you read any other F. Scott Fitzgerald novels?
I have. I've read a lot I think it was like in my American literature courses. So I did. And then recently his collection of short stories that came out, I Die For You, which what a great title again. Mm. But also a side interesting little fact was when I was living in D.C., his grave was a mile and a half from my house. His and Zelda's grave. And I would drive by it constantly on my way to McDonald's or wherever and didn't realize it for the longest time. And then finally, somebody was like, well, wait a minute. Like, have you not been? It's right there. And I kind of had this moment of, what have I been doing? And then I finally made it. And it was, it was quite an experience.
So, and how does The Great Gatsby compare to some of his other works? Because I haven't read some of his other books.
The thing with Fitzgerald is I think his language is beautiful. I'm a big fan of him in the sense of I've read up a little bit about him as well, and him and Zelda and their relationship, if we want to talk about like sort of a toxic, interesting combination. So I have this fascination with him as a writer beyond just the books as well. He's a very, very apt observer of society. And I think a lot of his work is very applicable to any time. So even if you picked up some of the other books, you'd find that you could relate to them, even in the current context, especially in Dubai. Actually, a lot of the stuff he writes about is this wealth and class and social stuff. And living here, you kind of read that and go, ah, okay. You can see a lot of society reflected.
I think it's interesting you mentioned F. Scott Fitzgerald as the writer figure and as somebody who's really interesting, because you're absolutely right. I remember, because I mentioned Letters of Note earlier as one of my favourite books. It collects correspondence from everywhere, all times and places, and puts them in one place. And F. Scott Fitzgerald crops up quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So there are some letters from him to Zelda. But also, if you want to go away and look this up, he's written a letter to his daughter when she was very young. And it's absolutely beautiful. And it's basically a list of all the things that she shouldn't worry about and then the few things that she should worry about in life.
Interesting.
And it's really wonderful. And I highly recommend it if you're listening to check that out. It's on lettersofnote.com.
Interesting. I have a feeling this is going to get me more in trouble.
So, Man, what do you think about The Great Gatsby?
I've watched both films. I think And I've read the book a few times in university and afterwards, and I think, like you say, as you grow older, you read it and with new appreciation of the language and the story and how it's so relatable. I think it's relatable now is there's this frivolousness to how we spend money and how we want to live and what we think is this grand lifestyle. And I think now in the age of social media, I sound quite repetitive, I'm always talking about the age of social media and how we're always trying to appear like we're living this certain kind of lifestyle. I think it's so perfectly reflected in this book.
Yeah, you're right.
And it's sort of this driver in a way, because, you know, Gatsby is on this mission to get something specific, or to, you know, get Daisy, and he wants to create this illusion to get her. And I just, one of the things in the novel that always gets me is the fact that he has these amazing parties in the hope that one day she will just walk in, which I think is so sad. And when you think about, if you take that idea out and think about it, how we apply that to our lives, and a lot of people apply that to our lives, doing all this stuff in the hope that something amazing that we long for will come. Because I always thought, what if he did end up with Daisy? Would that have made him whole and complete? I don't think so.
Yeah, he sounds like a very lonely person. I mean, there's a real sense of loneliness, even with the parties, and especially the way he dies at the end with, you know, nowhere there. But I agree with you. I don't know that that would be the thing that would complete him.
No.
Yeah.
Which is, again, thinking, okay, people are doing all these things online, social media, da-da-da-da, and is that actually the end goal? Is that the right end goal? It's probably not.
It's probably not, because I think maybe the search is the goal.
Exactly,
and it's a
yeah.
continuous sort of, you know, as long if that goes away, there's no purpose for Gatsby to look for anything anymore.
I just think as well, it's one of those novels that I'm excited to see, like, in another 10, 15, 20 years, what the next film adaptation will be, because it's such a rich story and the language is so rich as well. And I think it's kind of the thing that it will always be up for interpretation, how they, because the two films, one was in the 70s with Robert Redford and what's the woman with the short hair called?
Mia Farrow.
And that is so different from the one that just came out a couple of years ago with DiCaprio and I forget the actress's name, with the blonde hair.
I can see her face, but not her name.
Yeah.
Carrie Mulligan.
They're so different. And so I always love seeing how these film adaptations work. And, for example, Gone with the Wind, brilliant film adaptation, but I don't think it will ever be remade.
No.
Never.
I doubt it.
But with Gatsby, I think it's the kind of film that will always be remade every, like, 20, 30 years.
I think that's really interesting. The opulent emptiness aspect of it is something that you can constantly revisit. And, you know, until you'd mentioned it, I hadn't thought of the whole social media connection. And as soon as you said that, I was thinking, I can imagine Gatsby and Daisy with their own Instagram Instagram profiles. And I'm just picturing all the stuff that they would upload. And it's absolutely right, you know, the stuff that they present to the outside world versus what's actually going on in their lives. And the other thing that you made me think of was, I think often film adaptations for The Great Gatsby, that they're always going to be hit and miss when they're adapting something like this, because it's just such a perfect book. But you know how 10 Things I Hate About You adapted The Taming of the Shrew, because it went off in completely a different direction. Mm-hmm. I think that's why a lot of adaptations that are utterly brilliant stand alone.
Clueless
exactly.
Emma. Right, yeah.
So I think if they were going to adapt The Great Gatsby, they should just do something completely different.
I agree.
Something set today with kids and social media, maybe.
Exactly,
in
high school.
There you go. You've just come up with a brand new idea.
Yeah. So Netflix should call me.
That's about all that we have time for. Just really quickly recap the three titles that you brought with you.
Gone with the Wind, The Great Gatsby, and Pablo Neruda's 20 Love Poems and the Song of Despair.
Hanana Zahir, thank you so much for joining the island. We release you.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me. This has probably been the most enjoyable island experience I've had. So.
Yay. Right.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.